How about if I just start at the beginning? you could be honest.
Because you know what? They have the sweat equity that went into that memory that they're making with their friends and family. And that's what's important with us. And that's what the I Am Real World is about.
Well, that's a great question. You know, one of the best things about a spring food plot is you get a second chance if it fails.
Chasing Giants with Don Higgins. Brought to you by buyafarm.com, your source for farm, recreational properties, rural homes, and more. By tapping into Don's years of experience, dedication, and commitment, Chasing Giants focuses on the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails. Now, here is Don and co-host Terry Peer.
Well, welcome everyone to Chasing Giants, brought to you by buyafarm.com, episode 48 with Don Higgins, January 24th, 2021. Don, we got another week in the bag.
Yeah, we do. It won't be long. Those bucks will be shedding their antlers. In fact, I've heard a few reports and seen photos of a few that already have, but I'm sure the vast majority are still on their heads, but it won't be long. Another month, people will be finding a lot of them.
Yeah, I know. We're gonna take a little bit of an opportunity in the coming weeks to on episodes to talk about shed hunting and how we do it, and maybe some ideas on how to keep intrusion down even when we are shed hunting. But little too early for that. So you've been on the road. I think you left. You took Monday off of consulting and did some video work last week with Steve, who was up in town. Is that right?
Yeah, we spent the entire day, Steve Shields and I, and even my buddy Joe Johnson, who, turned me on to the Joey buck that I killed last November. Right. We filmed with him for a segment on a video on the Joey buck, but we knocked out probably at least four or five different YouTube videos. Yes. On Monday, and then I hit the road for Wisconsin on about 2 a.m. on Tuesday.
So we're going to try to provide some more content here in the near future on the Chasing Giants YouTube channel. All of that footage was recorded, so you'll be starting to see that drip feeding in, trying to get some more consistent content on the YouTube channel. So you looked like you had a cold week up in Wisconsin based on your Instagram pictures.
It was cold. Let's see, Friday morning, I forget what I posted. I think it was 4 degrees.
Yeah.
But yesterday morning, it was -4 when I got in my truck. So it was cold up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely brutal in certain parts of the country. And then I was watching one of the YouTube channels that I watch from the Dakotas and up in Montana, and they had days that it got up into the 60s last week. So really weird weather in certain places of the country right now.
Yeah. They said when I was in Wisconsin, that's as cold as it'd been all winter. They'd had a very mild winter up until then. And you might know I'd pick the coldest time of the winter to go.
That was the day that you were up there. So,
yeah.
So before we move on in the podcast, I kind of got something exciting to tell you that I hadn't even told you yet, and I guess I was waiting to tell you on the podcast.
All right.
There's been a lot going on in the world, and I've gotten to where I don't watch TV at all, regular TV. And I've kind of gotten addicted to finding certain YouTube channels that I subscribe to, and that's pretty much the only thing I watch is when they publish a new YouTube video. And I've come across a couple of these channels that aren't necessarily hunting channels, but they're outdoor lifestyle. So it's farming or firewood, sawmills, that type of thing. And I've ran across a couple of really good, they remind me a lot of us in that they're there for a core audience. You know, we're here, you know, we've said it multiple times. We're here for the outdoor community, not the outdoor industry, but not scared or not afraid to talk about our faith. And it just occurred to me that, you know, there's all these satellite channels and people out there that kind of take the same position as we do. but nobody kind of pulls it all together to try to direct people to good family content that's out there that's part of this outdoor lifestyle. So tomorrow we're going to have the first guest blog contributor on the Real World site that I'm going to do a mass mailing, and it'll be on social media. A gentleman by the name of Wes, who runs a really awesome YouTube channel out of Georgia, does a lot of sawmill, does honeybees. He actually killed his biggest buck of his life on a deadly dozen plot down in Georgia this year. I've gotten to know him a little bit through emails and text, and he actually wrote a guest blog that we're going to share on the YouTube site, and we want everybody to obviously go follow him at Fall Line Ridge on YouTube. And I just think it's a way that, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be hunting, but we're all interested in the outdoors. So I'm pretty excited about that. That's just one of many kind of guests that we're going to have on. That's just good family Christian content that's out there for the outdoor lifestyle.
Well, good deal. You know, I quit watching. All I used to watch on TV really was sports and news. And about 2 years ago or so, maybe it was longer than that, whenever the football players and everybody started kneeling, I quit watching sports.
Yep.
And I mean, I have not watched a single game of professional sports since. And then with all that's happened, you know, with the news media and their liberal slant, I've quit watching the news. So I'm basically to the point where I'm watching zero TV. Not that I've ever watched much anyway.
Right.
But it's good to hear that there's some other options out there.
So,
because for guys like us who, you know, have convictions that we're going to stick by, there's not a whole lot on regular TV.
No. So I'm like you. I mean, you used to tease me a little bit about Kentucky basketball because we're diehard UK basketball fans down here in Kentucky. And I haven't watched anything, actually. We had a get-together with my neighbors, and they had the game on last night. That was the first portion of any game that I've watched because they started doing all this kneeling stuff and staying in the locker room for the national anthem, and I'm just done with all of it. So if I can use our platform of Chasing Giants to be a positive content for those people, and then, you know, every once in a while have a guest blog come on the Real World, and, you know, just try to provide good, wholesome content out there for people that are interested, and kind of, I guess, blend some of these outlets of good entertainment for people and their families. I'm going to try to do it. So I'm really excited about it. So tomorrow, Wes's write-up, it's a little bit of a devotion, a little bit of outdoors. It's going to be up on Real World site. So if you're interested in that, you'll want to subscribe to the newsletter on the Real World site or follow our social media on Instagram or Facebook. But most of all, go out and follow, click like, and subscribe to Fall Line Ridge. Sawmills, chainsaws, honeybees, a little bit of hunting, good stuff. So I'm really excited about that. Wanted to tell everybody. So that's news to you, too.
Yeah, awesome. I look forward to seeing it.
All right. So outside of Wisconsin, last week, what do you got cooking this week?
More consulting. I'm going to stick closer to home for this week. I'm only going to be away from home one night.
You won't know what to do. Well, let me take that back. Robin, your wife Robin won't know what to do having you around all week.
Well, she may be ready for me to take another trip. Who knows?
You never know.
But, yeah, I've got a couple of big trips in the works in February, so I wanted to kind of take a week and where I could sleep in my own bed for a little bit.
Right. You've been hitting it pretty hard. So I'm going to be coming up, it looks like Tuesday. I had a beef at the slaughterhouse that I bought off of you. So we're gonna come up and it's ready to pick up. But I'm also going to pick up the rest of my cell cameras that are still up in Illinois to get them back and run the final test on them here in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be consulting on a property real close to where you're going to be, so maybe we can hook up for a few
minutes. Yep, hopefully we can. I can drop over and say hey. But We've gotten a lot of messages about the cell camera test and people wanting the final kind of summary of that. And until I can set these cameras side by side, I'm not going to let my personal bias that I've developed at this point to basically change the methodology in which I was going to do it. So these things have been out working all hunting season. And sometime here in the next couple of weeks, we're going to bring them and put them on a grid on a soccer field so we have the exact same conditions for day and nighttime. And then we'll drive either the quiet cat bike or my side-by-side or both to not only test the shutter speed, the clarity at different distances and speeds, but also the recovery time from picture to picture. So I'm going to guess that we'll have the final write-up on that probably by the end of February, early March. And I don't really have a place to do it, so we've talked about it a little bit before. We'll probably do that on the Higgins Outdoors blog page, if you're still all right with that. But that's probably the best place we can put all that data out there for people.
Yeah, sounds good. I've seen plenty of messages come through about it, so yep. I know a lot of people are looking forward to hearing the final results.
Mm-hmm. I know that real quick, to give a little bit of a real world update, the pilot program for the corn and Enlist beans has been crazy. But we also, this is changing the subject quite a bit, our seedsman Dwayne Hopkins gave us some tools that we're going to be able to share to our listeners about learning about the Enlist program, meaning the chemicals that can be used, because there's a lot of little caveats inside of just saying the word 2,4-D in the agriculture arena that we need to make sure food plotters have this information at their disposal. So one of the things we're going to work into a lot of content we're going to be publishing here in the near future is going to be some Enlist training for those people that are getting ready to be on that pilot program.
That sounds good. I know there's a lot of interest in it, and especially it seems like the corn. You know, I thought the Enlist beans would generate the most interest, but really that corn, and I'm just hearing more questions and more interest in that than I am anything. And I think for good reasons, I'm more interested in it myself, just for my own property.
Right.
So
I think the Enlist program is going to be for the people that have specific needs, you know, because of, you know, the chemical traits and weed resistance. The corn is something completely new that I think people have always wanted corn, but, you know, corn's a little bit of an unknown for a lot of people, and it's not easy to plant. You know, the average food plotter will probably struggle a little bit with finding the equipment, but for the serious guys who make up a big part of the demographic of people that listen to this podcast and obviously the customer base, they're really excited. When you start talking over 200% of the calories in this corn than normal ag corn, that's going to be a game changer for some people.
Well, and the attraction. I mean, not only is it better for the deer and they get more out of it, but it's more attractive to them. And, you know, we talked last week about the baiting in Ohio, and, you know, the corn piles are everywhere there. I'm telling you, there's an opportunity for somebody to grow this corn, pick it with their corn picker and put it in a crib and sell this ear corn. Because I'm telling you, if your neighbor had regular corn and you had this NutriCrape corn, you'd have the deer.
Right.
Also for putting in feeders.
Right.
Shelled corn, this NutriCrape corn, if it was ran through a combine, you know, and harvested that way, I can see people planting 40, 80 acres of it just for either selling to deer hunters or making deer feed.
Well, I want to circle back on a point that you made. I'm not sure how many episodes ago it was, but it was the analogy you used: a vending machine, a fast food restaurant, and maybe like a sit-down buffet or something like that. mm-hmm. when you're talking about the drawing power. So the corn, when you're looking at it, it's not something that you're ever going to necessarily put a quarter acre out, right? When you talk about an acre plus of diverse food source with this corn in the middle, that gets more into the analogy you were using with that drawing power, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It just, it's another food source at the buffet. And it just, it has pulling power. You know, a small plot just does not have the pulling power of a big one. And when you take a big one and then you diversify the foods within it, it has even more power. And this NutriCrave corn is just another perfect tool for that.
And you've talked openly around us about what you've seen on your farm and how many just critters are in that patch of corn versus just a little ways away where their standard ag corn's at. So they obviously must like it.
There's no doubt about it.
All right.
I'll be planting it every year, and I've never been a big corn fan. You know, it's takes a little more maintenance and care, higher fertility, takes some decent equipment, you know, for plant spacing. But after seeing what I saw this year, I will always have some NutriCrave corn on my place.
Right. So we're going to be putting out some training information about it, you know, more about the type of corn. I know a lot of people for the pilot program have questioned, you know, do we have it to where it's Roundup ready? So we'll be providing some information because this is not in the pilot program, but what's going to come in the future and then what you can do in the meantime. We're going to be putting some stuff out on that on the Real World site. But and then probably some more planting training stuff out there. Speaking of some training stuff as far as just food plotters getting more information, I'm really happy with some of the content that our good friend Josh Pretzer out in Kansas have started doing this past week on his Instagram page. And you know, I reached out to Josh Pretzer and his friend Aaron Morgan years ago when they had a group, I think it was called Invested Outdoors, and I reached out to them, and Josh was, what appealed to me is Josh was, I don't know how many generations he is as a row crop farmer, but just kills some giants out there in Kansas, and he started doing a project for us, a land manager's perspective from a farmer, and he's doing a super job right now, doing some stories and training on his Instagram page about what fertilizer numbers mean, what those individual components of fertilizer mean for your soil health. So it's a great learning tool for young food plotters that don't necessarily understand all this yet. So go out and check out Josh Pretzer's Instagram page. Just search Pretzer, and it'll come up. But good information. I actually shared some of it on Real World site today. So it's just one of those things that we can learn a little bit from. So, unless you got something else, I'm kind of excited about this lessons from the research heard today because it evolves, and I think it's centered around a topic that people don't really understand a lot, and that is genetics.
Yeah, today we're going to talk specifically about antler genetics, and you know what I learned in breeding those captive deer is that there are certain traits, antler traits, that are easier to breed for or more heritable, if you will, and others that are much more difficult. The easiest antler trait to breed for is mass. You can easily increase the mass and get just phenomenal mass on whitetails through selective breeding. One of the lowest heritable traits is antler width. It's very difficult to create a line of deer that, you know, has wide spreads.
Okay, so you're meaning when you say width, you mean the spread of the antlers,
right?
Okay.
I mean, you can create a line of deer, a bloodline of deer, where the mass is just there on, you know, almost every animal. generation after generation. But when it comes to trait like spread, that is very difficult. I mean, it's just a random here and there animal that will carry that trait. And then those are the two extremes. And then you've got things like number of points, which is fairly heritable. You can easily increase the number of points on a whitetail's rack through breeding the antler genetics. Another one that's not nearly as easily bred for is antler height or length, tine length. Yeah, it's a little bit easier than spread, but it's still one that, you know, kind of eludes the breeder, if you will. It's just very interesting. And all the years that I had these deer, you know, the two things that I focused on was nutrition and genetics. As I tried to just learn more about whitetails and the antler genetics, the various traits and how easily or how difficult that trait is passed on from one generation to another is one of those things I found very interesting.
So can I pick your brain about a couple things when we're talking about antler genetics?
Sure.
So we hear a lot of times about a buck that was shot that somebody thinks that it was the buck's son from the previous year or a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. How does that really fall into play when we're talking about dispersal of buck fawns and the likelihood of that happening? I mean, there's got to be some cases where it might be the son of a buck that you shot years prior. But what do you think that holds water, or is that something that people are a little bit confused about?
Well, I don't think it happens near as much. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I don't think it happens near as much as what people think. You know, the interesting thing, and I was going to save this for another episode, but the interesting thing about antler genetics is that a buck will get more, I don't know how to word this, he will get more of his antler genetics from his mother than he will his father.
So the traits of that rack is what you're talking about.
Right.
Okay.
The traits of that rack will come more from his maternal grandfather than it will his own father. As strange as that sounds.
So explain that a little bit more. So maternal grandfather. So what's that mean?
Yeah, his mother's father.
So his mother's father.
Yeah, because she is carrying the genetics of her father.
So if we're seeing a buck that maybe looked like a couple generations before, say maybe 4, 5, 6 years previous, the likelihood of that being that buck's grandchild through the mother has more probability than it being the son.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Yep. And, you know, captive deer breeders routinely will tell you that the doe contributes at least 60% of the antler genetics, with the sire contributing 40%. And that's minimum 60%. Some guys think it's even higher. You know, one interesting thing talking about genetics is through captive, or my experience with the captive deer, I learned about something called super does. And these super does carry those large antler genetics that they pass on to their offspring. And what these super does will do is, no matter what buck they are bred to, the sons that they give birth to will be bigger than their fathers. Wow. So I know, you know, most of us have seen those photos of those wild and crazy, those huge captive deer.
Right.
Well, how did they get that way? It's through these super does that it's happening. So let's just say, for example, a doe was bred by a buck that scored I don't know, 200 inches at 3 years old. Well, if it's a super doe, her son will be bigger than 200 inches at 3 years old.
I see.
He will beat his father at every age if he comes from one of these super does.
Just because now, of the genetics she's bringing to the table.
Yep. So her genetics have more influence on her son's antlers than his father does.
Huh. Interesting.
But the bad thing, or I shouldn't say it's bad, but the thing about it is to find those does, it takes so long because, you know, that doe has to give birth and then her offspring have to have lived long enough to be able to compare to their sire or their father. So to actually find one of those super does, it takes some time.
Right.
But when you go to
like the top 40 deer auction, you know, everybody focuses on these monster whitetails that are being sold, you know. But I know that there's some of these super does that bring a really high price too when you're talking about the captive industry.
Well, in the captive industry, they're not only, when they look at an animal's pedigree, they're not only looking for the large antlered bucks in that pedigree, they're looking for these super does in that pedigree. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of, in the captive industry, there's been a lot of giant bucks who never produced offspring that were even close to being as good as they were.
Oh, interesting.
So, but those does are the ones that are passing it on.
Okay. So as we're looking if we're looking at our properties, what can be our takeaway from this as far as, you know, managing the herd, what we're doing right now with, you know, if our state allows us to put mineral out, you know, with fetal programming, how does this tie back to the average guy that's basically trying to make his farm the best it can be?
Well, and that's where I was going to go next, Terry. There's really, when it comes to the wild herd, I mean, there is absolutely no way whatsoever that you can know where these does are or which one of these super does is out there in the wild. Now, I think that's, you know, there's always these pockets in the wild that produce giant bucks.
Right.
You know, there'll be an area of maybe 2 or 3 square miles where there's 200 inch bucks on a very consistent basis.
Right.
Or you know, you get out into Iowa and there's certain properties that produce multiple 200 inch bucks, you know, in a short time span. And my theory is that there's one of them super does somewhere, you know, close to that area anyway.
Right.
And it's her fawns.
Gotcha.
Now, when you throw the whole fetal programming thing in there or the dispersal of the fawns, you know, that kind of, there's just a lot of theories and there's really no way to prove them. Because if he did have a super doe in an area, and she lived long enough to produce multiple buck fawns, you would think those fawns would disperse and end up who knows where. They're surely not all going to end up at the same farm 5-10 miles away.
Right. I mean, but even if you make your square on the checkerboard the most appealing place possible with no intrusion, the likelihood of generation after generation after generation of buck fawns that came from a super doe coming there would still be a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that there is some weight to what we call good genetic pockets, though, where some areas are just a whole lot better than others. And I don't mean, you know, West Virginia mountain deer compared to Iowa deer. I'm talking about, you know, certain sections or certain areas, there's just always a big one there.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So this is my last question to put you on the spot. And,
okay.
And I don't know how you're going to answer it or not, but I've actually thought about this or not. What's the likelihood that Smokey and Mel were related somehow?
Well, I've thought about that myself and I think there's a really good chance that they were. I mean, there had never been a buck on my farm over 180 inches until Smokey. He was the first one in you know, 30 years of managing this farm.
He was the first one that broke 180.
And then he, you know, a year later, he broke 200. Well, Mel is the second one that broke 180 and 200. There's never been another buck over 180 on my farm except those two. And they both went over 200. So, and they've got some similar characteristics. You know, they both have a fairly wide spread rack. Both had forked tines. I think there's a really good chance that they're related somehow.
That's interesting.
But I'm not going to say that, you know, a lot of guys would say, well, Mel is Smokey's son. And I'm not going to take it that far.
Gotcha. But somewhere along the line, it's very likely.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they've got the same mother. But then again, if they do, why didn't either one of them disperse?
Right.
You know, I don't know what the connection is, but I do believe they're related somehow.
But at the same time, Mel had such a big wide range, you were just in his core somewhere. I mean,
yep.
You know, I mean, he may have dispersed. He just came back. I mean, good grief. That deer covered so much ground that it's hard to tell. So... it's interesting to think about it when we look at genetics. So maybe sometime here this spring we can take another opportunity to talk a little bit more about circling back and talking more in depth about culling deer in each age class, because I know that was a topic that came up in several of the seminars in Northeast Ohio that I think could help people understand a little bit more about what to do with their farms when they're talking about culling deer and antler genetics. So, unless you got something else, we're 32 minutes in. You want to go off to the biofarm segment?
Yeah, we probably should. We got a lot of things to cover.
All right. Sounds great.
Biofarm.com is your source for farm, recreational properties, rural homes, and more. Now, here is Don Higgins with this week's featured property.
Okay, this week's featured property is a new listing. It's 195 acres in Wayne County. It's about a half a mile from Samdale Lake State Conservation Area. The property has a beautiful 6-acre home site overlooking a 2.5-acre stocked pond. The pond has an island and a gazebo. There's road access on two sides of this property. It's got a really nice finished 32-foot by 40-foot Morton building with HVAC and rural water. I mean, you could pull your camper right up there and hook up. There's 200 amp electrical service, outside water hydrant, electrical outlets outside and everything. It's got three overhead insulated doors with electric openers. It's just a really nice shed. You need to go on the website to see this. But it's got the aeration septic system, washer dryer hookup. I mean, this is a nice, nice building. Of the 195 acres, there's 59 acres in CRP tree program with an annual income of over $6,000. And there's 14 years left on that CRP contract. So the new owner for the next 14 years would be getting over $6,000 in CRP payments. And the taxes are only $2,123. So that CRP would easily take care of your taxes and give you about $4,000, a little over $4,000 remaining. There's a area that has a shallow water wetland for waterfowl. There's a target range. Shots can be taken safely up to 500 yards. That's right up your alley, Terry.
Yeah, I'm digging this.
Yeah, but all kinds of information on this property on the BioFarm website. The agent is Don Bailey, whose phone number is 618-919-1031. Again, just go on the biofarm.com website, look for 195 acres in Wayne County.
I'm looking at the listing right now, and it is an absolute gorgeous property. They got a one picture in here with a bunch of sheds on the picnic table inside of that Morton building, and there's some bruisers there. But the lake is just fantastic. I could just see a real nice house built behind that. But go to biofarm.com, search Wayne County, and Don Bailey's the agent. Don, tell, where is Wayne County? I should know this, but I don't. Where is Wayne County at?
No, it's the Fairfield would be the county seat.
Gotcha.
It's south of Effingham. It's right Interstate 64 would go through Wayne County.
Okay. So easy access to it. So looks like a really, really nice property. I don't think this one will last very long. So, all right. Thanks to our friends at BioFarm. Please go out, follow their social media on Facebook, and view this listing of Don Bailey's in Wayne County. Really nice piece of property.
Yep.
So before we go on to the listener submitted questions, you want to give a hat, apparel, and book update from HigginsOutdoors.com?
Yeah, I probably should. I'm telling you what, the orders have been flooding in, and my wife spent all afternoon packaging things today. In fact, when I came in here to do the podcast, she had just finished up because she had ran out of hats, and she'd run out of a one size of t-shirt. So there's a lot of you that have ordered hats. We'll be getting them real soon because they'll go out in the mail tomorrow, but we didn't have enough to fill all orders. So we got more hats coming.
Yep.
T-shirts too. If you order t-shirts, I think most of those orders were processed. Books, we sold more books this winter than ever. And sure appreciate everyone's support. So if you ordered something, you should be getting it soon.
So basically what happened, we put these on your website, these Chasing Giants hats, as pre-sale, but so many people bought them so fast that it helped us. We went ahead and told our vendor, our good friend Stephanie Bryson in East Tennessee, to go ahead and start running them because you guys went ahead and bought them early. And we thought we ordered enough that we would be close. It's not even a drop in the bucket. So she's in process of making the next run. So even though we told everybody they would not start shipping until around the beginning of February, there's a lot of you that placed your orders early that will go ahead and be getting those in the mail. They'll go out tomorrow. So thanks everybody for going ahead and doing that. At some point we're going to cut these off. So if you want one and, please go on to Higgins Outdoors and go to his store. There's t-shirts. Obviously, Don's two books are there, but I think you're about ready to run out of the first book and then also these hats.
Yep. We are down to the last box of my first book, which was published back in 2005, about 15 years ago. But I bought a bunch of them when I had them printed. And we're down to the very last box. I think
no reprints, right?
No, actually, I'm thinking about maybe writing a third book one of these days, but this will be the end of this one. So I think there's about 30 books in a case.
I'm guessing if there's a third book, it's probably going to be titled Chasing Giants.
Well, you're a mind reader. Maybe Chasing Giants in the Real World.
There you go. All right, well, that sounds good. Let's move on. We got some good questions for tonight.
Yep, the first question comes from Tom. I hope I pronounced your name right, Tom. It's either Beeb or Beebe. But Tom is from Hale, Michigan. He says, Don and Terry, I am a new listener of the podcast, and you guys do a great job. Keep up the good work. Unfortunately, I live and hunt in northern Michigan, where a 125-inch deer is an absolute giant. But we still chase them. I've killed a 4-year-old and a couple of 5-year-olds, none of them scoring over 118 inches. We have habitat here for better bucks, but the Michigan mindset is, if I don't shoot this 8-point, my neighbor will, and most deer don't live past 2 or 3 years old. I love the quote that a mature buck hunter shouldn't be judged by what he kills, but what he doesn't kill. We are trying to change the culture around here, but it's a work in progress. On to my question. I have read that bucks won't shed their antlers until all the does have been bred and their testosterone level drops. In previous years, we've seen bucks start dropping antlers as early as December 13th, which makes sense. But most years, as is this year, there are still bucks that carry their antlers into mid to late January. Was that theory wrong that I read in the past, or could there still be a second or third cycle does not bred yet in mid to late January? Or maybe they just don't drop right away. One of our properties has a really good buck to doe ratio, 1-to-1 or maybe 1.5-to-1, with medium to low deer density, where I highly doubt there would be any does still to be bred this late. Another property we own has horrible buck-to-doe ratio of 1 to 10 and really high deer density, where I could certainly see does not getting bred in their first or even second cycles. We saw rut activity well into December this year, so we were using a fair amount of doe estrus scent wicks to try and lure our target bucks until mid-December. This may have contributed to them still carrying their antlers well into January. Your thoughts? Sorry for the long-winded question, but just curious what you've seen with your research, Hurt. Thanks again.
We're going to spend a little time on this one, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, I picked this one because I think the rut is just very misunderstood by most hunters. And he's also talking about bucks shedding their antlers as it relates to the rut. And we're getting into that time where bucks are starting to shed. But I can tell you that buck shedding has absolutely nothing to do with whether does got bred or not. It's the, decreasing daylight hours and the lower levels of decreasing levels of testosterone is what's making these antlers drop. But it's absolutely not tied in any way to does getting bred or not getting bred. Was there other questions there,
well,
Terry?
I think if it's okay, there's a couple things. I don't know how many of the episodes that Tom has listened to, but there's a couple things that I think we need to kind of at least point him back to other episodes, even though we don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. Let's talk first about, real quick, tell everybody what your thoughts are on does still being in heat second and third cycle versus doe fawns. We've talked about this before. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but just quick overview.
Yeah, and you make a great point, Terry, that there's – I've said it before, there's only one rut. And when a doe comes in the heat, it's almost unheard of that she's not going to get bred. And I guess maybe one good way to put it or to think about it is, you know, a farmer has got a cow herd, and he may have 50 cows, but he's got one bull. One buck deer can take care of a bunch of does. Those does aren't all coming to heat in the same day. And one buck can take care of a lot of does. The same way one bull can take care of a lot of cows.
And a yearling buck can breed a doe.
Oh, absolutely.
So
and even a buck that has shed his antlers and has low testosterone, that doesn't mean he has no testosterone. He could still breed a doe.
So Tom, go back and listen to a couple previous episodes where we talked about the misconception of a second or third cycle. And maybe one of these days that I'm up there, we can do a YouTube and Facebook Live with Don and maybe have a grease board and kind of draw this pyramid where Don talked about, you know, after every doe gets bred, the number of open does in heat gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So what people are misinterpreting the second and third rut are just those bucks covering more ground, trying to find the few does that are still in heat. There was one other point, so go back and listen to that, and let us know if you have any more questions. The other thing that I found kind of interesting with his questions was, where was it? You already mentioned that there's nothing to do, no relationship with dropping antlers versus the rut, but he made mention about buck to doe ratios and having something to do with that. And I don't think there's really a correlation there either.
No, basically the buck to doe ratio, if you've got the more does you got, I'm trying to think of the best way to word it, the more even your buck to doe ratio is, for example, 1-to-1, one buck to one doe, the more buck activity you're going to see, because that buck is, he's looking for a hot doe, and there's so many bucks. I mean, the bucks are equal the number of does, but when you get in a situation like he talked about with one buck to 10 does, well, the buck doesn't have to look as hard, because when one doe goes out of heat, it doesn't take him that long to find the next one. He doesn't have to go searching.
Okay.
So the amount of buck activity you see when the buck to doe ratio gets out of hand is, you know, just a whole lot less.
All right. So here's a question for you, based on your captive herd that you had. I know that before the rut, you would go in and cut the antlers off because these bucks would kill each other, you know, in captivity. Could you tell when they would shed, if there was any correlation? Like you say, a doe will come into heat close to the same time every year. Does an individual buck, is there a pattern of when they will drop, or is that based on the outside factors that you were talking about a little bit ago?
Well, there is a little bit of that, the annual cycle. It varies from buck to buck, not only the growth cycle, but the shedding of the antler cycle. And it's not near as defined as a lot of other things, but, you know, if you got a buck that typically sheds in, say, the end of January, well, it's not going to be a specific day.
Right.
But he's typically always going to shed, you know, in late January, where, you know, other bucks are late shedders. Maybe they carry them into March, and if those bucks are going to do it about every year. Unless there's some unusual stress comes along, they get injured, or you have a typical or unusually bad winter, that stress can make them shed early.
Yeah. I do want to say something to Tom, though. I mean, he said that he's killed a 4-year-old and 2 5-year-olds. Buddy, a mature buck is a hard animal to kill, whether he's got 118 inches of antler or 180 inches of antler. Once they get past 4 years old, that's a different animal, and congrats to you for being able to close the deal on those mature bucks. That doesn't have anything to do with their antler size. He's just as smart no matter what size the antlers are on top of his head.
That's for sure. I've said it many times, you know, the easiest mature buck I ever killed was Smokey, 206 inches. But I knew I was going to kill that buck. So the rack on their head doesn't have anything to do with how smart they are.
So, Buddy, is you made the comment, if I don't shoot the 8-point, my neighbor will. That isn't a Michigan thing, man. That is an everywhere thing. We deal with that in Kentucky. Don deals with it in Illinois on his home farm, right? You had a good buck that was on your up-and-comer list get shot this year. So, you know, it's whether or not we're going to use that as an excuse in lowering our standards, in my opinion. I mean, if it's just the easy way out. Well, if I don't shoot it, my neighbor will. Well, maybe not. You might be able to do stuff with your property with lack of intrusion and habitat that he's got a better chance to survive. So
yep.
I don't think that's a Michigan thing. I think every podcast listener that's listening to this right now can hold their hand up and say, I deal with the same thing. when I decide not to shoot something, there's a very good chance my neighbor is going to shoot it. It's just the way it is. Hunting in the real
it's
world.
It's everywhere, but he's right. The Michigan mentality Yeah, I travel all over the country, and there's traditions, deer hunting traditions and culture that changes a little bit from state to state. But Michigan is its own world. I'm just telling you, some people up there have their own way of thinking. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying, I mean, I can listen to somebody make a post or just read a post on the internet, and I can tell when it's a Michigan guy. Those people are just a different breed.
Yeah.
And there's some extremely serious deer hunters up there.
Their hunting heritage, you know.
Yeah, it's just a different culture is what it is. But, all right, we'll move on to the next question.
Good question, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Michael Sudbrock from X-Line, Iowa. Michael says, with more seasons behind me than in front of me, your podcasts are the real deal. Thank you for your candidness. It is appreciated. My question is predator control. Coyotes are plentiful here in southern Iowa. I notice that even in thick cover, a coyote presence seems to clear the area of deer. I see this also as a real form of stress, and I'm requesting your opinion on their effect on mature bucks. After the season, I try to work at reducing their population, mainly by calling them from these areas into the edges. Am I doing more harm than good? Should I consider trapping? Thank you for your consideration in this matter. Michael, I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that coyotes are a stress factor on deer. I know of a specific property. It used to be fantastic deer hunting. And today it's almost next to worthless because it's just overrun with coyotes. It's almost become a coyote sanctuary. It's fairly close to town. And those coyotes live in this thicket, but at night they run into town. They eat out of trash cans and people's cats, to be real honest about it. And, I've tried talking to the landowner to no avail. He just doesn't, want people to go in there and shoot coyotes. And I'm telling him they need to be shot. As far as trapping, I'm a big fan of trapping. As long as it's done, you know, away from the sanctuary of your property, out on the edges, open fields and such, that's where the best place to trap coyotes is anyway, not in the brush.
Right.
So I'm a big fan of trapping, but what I really like more than anything is these guys that are calling them at night now, you know, using these night vision scopes and such, because they can call them, and they don't have to even be close to the brush. I've got a very good friend, Todd Hewing, that probably has killed more of them at night than just about anybody, at least in this area. And, you know, the way he does it, he doesn't even go close to the deer cover.
Right.
He calls them almost not to the road, but close to the road and in wide open fields.
Right.
Those guys have definitely put a hurting on the coyotes in my area, which is fantastic. From a deer hunter standpoint. So you definitely want to try doing whatever you can to control the coyote population because they will certainly affect the deer herd on a property.
And you just asked this question to the guy who was chasing a 220-inch buck and shot a coyote.
That's a good point.
So, yeah, I mean, That's how, and I've been with you before where we've been hunting a specific buck and a coyote came out and shoot it, hunts over, shoot it.
Yep. Coyotes always get shot.
Yep. So, I tell you another, you were talking about that, and that's one of the projects I have for this year. I just bought a Browning X-Bolt Hell's Canyon Max Long Range that I'm going to build it with a suppressor and a thermal on it, to do some of this. I've watched, I know Team Radical, has, dirt naps, I think is what they call it. I think they're up to, I don't know, 17 editions of this. If you want to see some really awesome footage with thermals, go check that out. But some of that coyote footage at nighttime, it just looks like an absolute blast. But I agree with you going into your sanctuaries and trying to do this, but you know, all this footage that you see is wide open ag country, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So not putting any intrusion or pressure on it, but getting rid of them suckers.
There was a few years back, I mean, it's probably been 10 years ago now, where the deer on my place, with my trail cameras, I was literally getting about as many coyote pictures as I was deer. And my deer herd was just not there. It was not what it had been. And I attributed it to all the number of coyotes I had. Well, a friend of mine has a relative that's a really, really good coyote trapper. And he put me in contact with him, and I had him come out. And in one fall, I shot 3 coyotes with my bow, and then this trapper caught 14 on me.
Wow.
So on my 120 acres, we killed 17 coyotes.
Wow.
And that made a difference, but there were still some around, no doubt about it.
Right.
And that turned my place around, and I'm thinking that was at least 10 years ago.
Well, I don't
think. And since then, we've kept them under control.
It might be a better question for somebody that knows a lot more about predator hunting than us, maybe sometime that I'm talking with Todd. I don't think predator control is a 1 year and you're done thing, because I think if you went in and shot 14 to 17 of them, I think there's others that'll just move right in. So it's a year to year task, I think, as part of your habitat. I don't think it's just a 1 year thing and you're done.
Well, yeah, I agree 100%. It's a continuous, you know, effort. Just like planting your food plots, maintaining your property, it never ends. You do it every year.
But great question. I just encourage you to do it without getting, you know, into your main core. That's the tough part. You don't want to add pressure doing it. Same thing with coons.
Yep.
All right. Great question.
Yep. We'll move on to the last one. It comes from Matt Hargis from Prairie Grove, Arkansas. Matt says, Don and Terry, I have really enjoyed listening to your podcast and can't say thank you enough. I just recently found the podcast, so I am still quite a few episodes behind, but it has definitely given me a few ideas for our hunting lease. My question to you both is, how do you feel about peeing off your stand? I know it's not ideal, but sometimes nature calls earlier than expected, and or many guys sit all day, so I wanted to get your thoughts. I appreciate your time and keep up the good work. Peeing. Well, Matt, I can tell you, years ago, I carried a bottle around to pee in, and because I didn't want to pee out of my stand. And I thought, one day I did this for years. And one day I looked at that bottle and I thought, this thing has got to stink. Yeah, I've been peeing in it, you know, for 3 months a season, dumping it out, and it's got to stink. And I just quit doing it. And I decided I was going to pee out of my stand and see what happened, see if it spooked deer or whatever. Well, literally the very first time I ever peed out of my stand, and I remember the exact tree where it happened at, the very tree where it happened at. I peed out of my stand, and, you know, below my stand, it was a grassy area. And I hadn't peed out of my stand 15 minutes, and here comes this 2-year-old 8-pointer walking by, and he smelled where I peed. And he went over and started sniffing that grass and even ate some of that grass, but I had just peed out of my stand right under me. And I made up my mind that day I was peeing out of my stand from then on, and have been. Terry, what do you think about peeing out of a stand?
I've made more of a mess trying to pee into a bottle than what it's worth. So, you know, there's two problems. Number one, it's peeing, and number two. So, yeah, Code Browns are definitely not a hunter's friend, so there's nothing you can do about that. So,
I got a good pee story for you, actually. Right,
let's hear it. tell me you had it out and a booner walked by.
No, this is even better.
Okay.
This is even better. Several years ago, I just started consulting. I mean, this has probably been 10 years ago, too. I just started doing a few consulting jobs. And there was this I consulted on a property for a gentleman that was, he's a few years older than me. I guess he's probably at least 10 years older than me. And I was trying to get him to see, you know, the potential that his property had. And he was just having trouble buying in. So I invited him to come to my farm and hunt with me, just to observe the deer as much as anything, how many deer were there and how you could sit in your stand and see multiple bucks on a hunt and things like that. So he showed up at my house one Saturday morning before daylight. And we went and got in an enclosed blind, and we're sitting there, you know, and we'd seen a few deer, and we'd been there, it was a couple hours after daylight, and the old guy looks at me and he says, "Hey," he says, "what do you do when you're up here and you got to pee?" And I said, "Well, I typically just whip it out the window and pee." and he gave me the strangest look, and he said, "Son," he said, if you're whipping it at all, the good Lord has blessed you a whole lot that he's blessed me." I busted out laughing, and he did too. And I said, "Just open the back door and make sure it's pointed out." I just never have forgot that story. "Son, if you're whipping it at all, the good Lord has blessed you a lot more than he has me."
Oh boy. Yeah, I've actually thought about cutting a hole with a hole saw in the bottom of my enclosed blinds and running a piece of PVC down into the ground and burying it and then putting a cap on it up in the top, but it's not worth it. Now, I will ask you a question. Have you ever peed in a scrape before?
Oh yeah.
So yep. If you're out walking a farm, pulling a trail camera and you walk up on a scrape and have the urge, if God blessed you enough, do you whip it out and pee in the scrape or not?
You know what? I should have warned you before we ever started recording, Terry, that I was going to tell that story. Then you could have queued up that song. Remember that song from the 1980s? I think it was Whip It Good.
Good grief. It's going downhill quick.
We could have ended the podcast instead of with our regular music.
Yeah,
we could have ended
it
with that song.
Yeah, absolutely.
But no, I have peed in scrapes, and I guarantee you the bucks will come right up there and hit them. So, I mean, why would you worry about peeing if you can pee in a scrape and it makes them work the scrape?
Yeah.
Hey, if you think about it, every critter in the woods is out there peeing. The coyotes are peeing, the foxes, coons.
It just
whatever.
Never fails for me when I have to pee. It's always at the wrong time, especially in the rut. It never fails. So,
well, I'll tell you what, when you get older, get my age, and you always got to pee, so it's always the wrong time.
So,
you peed 5 minutes earlier, you got to do it again.
Well, I don't know about God blessing somebody to whip it or not, but I can attest to it. I've been in the woods with Don Higgins before when a code brown alerted, and there's nothing that will end a deer hunting sit faster than Don looking at you and saying, "Code brown, got to go."
I wouldn't advise code brown in a scrape.
All right, Matt, you got more than what you asked for on that one, buddy. We need tea.
We better just leave that.
We could make some. We could make some Code Brown T-shirts.
Well, I just guarantee next week, whenever you want to throw a surprise on me during the podcast, you're going to have the music queued up.
Yeah, I did not know that was coming. So, all right. Well, why don't you take us out? We hope everybody has a blessed week and be safe out there.
All right. We want to thank our sponsors, BuyAFarm.com, Gunning Buy, Lone Wolf, Matthews, Quiet Cat, Real World Wildlife Products, and Vortex Optics. Have a good week, everybody.
Whip it!